Welcome to The Rundown. I'm your host, Justin Pugliese. This podcast is dedicated to you, the run community. Each episode, we bring you interviews with top athletes and community leaders. They'll share their stories, tips, and tricks to inspire and motivate you to keep running. Ultimately, we're all just here to have fun. From elite runners to weekend warriors, find out how people get started and why they keep going. So listen up, tell your run buddies, and don't forget to subscribe. You can find us on Apple Music, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
And then from 5K on, I was on my own, running faster than I've ever run in my life. And I was just like, okay, I've got to hang on because I know they're coming after me. So when I'm in this position, I just imagine they're right on my heels. So I kept the pressure up on myself and just pushed every single step and wound up winning, I think, by a decent margin. I don't think anyone was behind me, even though in my head they were right on my heels.
On this episode of The Rundown, I got to interview the fastest marathoner on the show to date, Nicole Stevenson. She took up running at a very young age and competed through high school and university. She enjoyed long distance running the most and won her first coached marathon in Toronto with a time of 2 hours and 36 minutes. She went on to improve to a personal best time of 2 hours 32 minutes and earned the Canadian National Marathon title. Nicole is now retired from competitive running, but she continues to share her passion and knowledge with high-performing athletes, coaching and helping them reach their full potential, the same way she was supported throughout her successful career. Are you already subscribed to The Rundown, running with WRG, and still can't get enough? Sign up to their weekly newsletter and always stay connected. You can learn more about what's happening in the community, hear about exclusive run events, and stay up to date with the podcast. Just go to iamarunner.ca and subscribe. Simple as that. You'll never miss a beat. In this week's news, spring is finally here, and race season is set to begin. On April 10th, it's the 5th anniversary of the Tour de l'Horloge in Old Montreal. You can sign up to run or walk the 1, 5, 8, or 13 kilometer distance. It's a nice little test to start the year, so lace up your kicks and shake off that winter rust. On April 15th, it's one of the biggest marathons of the year, the 124th Boston Marathon. It's personally my favorite weekend and race to date, so I can't wait to be back running it again. I'm even more excited to share the course with defending men and women champions from 2018, Yuki Kawauchi and Des Linden. The competition this year is going to be stiff, with 5 former men's champions and 4 former women's champions returning. That's a lot of firepower for one race, so it'll be interesting to see how this one plays out. A little word of advice for anyone racing Boston for the first time. Just enjoy the ride. This is your victory lap and an experience you'll never forget. Finally, if you're looking for a more challenging local race, Scotiabank Montreal is right around the corner. It's set to take place on April 27th and 28th and will cover the 5, 10, and 21 kilometer distance. You can sign up directly on the website, but if you'd like to run for a good cause, you can join the neurosurgery team at St. Justine's Hospital instead and run for somebody who can't. Please reach out directly if you'd like to sign up. Make sure to check the show notes for links and more information. That's all for now. Gotta run. We've had some pretty quick marathoners on the show, but I'd like to introduce to you Nicole Stevenson, the fastest one we're going to have on the show so far. Welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for coming in today.
And fastest to date, but I'm sure it's just another week away before you've got your next fastest marathoner.
Hope so. That's the idea, to keep people getting better in the community and you're a coach too. So maybe you'll be the one helping them do that.
That'd be great. Yeah.
Great to have you in. I think we met, it must have been 2017, I want to say, just after my second Ironman. And it's funny because we didn't even meet on a run, but you were helping us on a... or myself, Mo, and Ariane on a tempo run, and you were riding the bike next to us.
That's right. Yep, I was the old lady on the bike.
And I didn't know at the time, but you were a pretty good runner too.
Yep, back in the day, yeah.
So what's your background? Like, how did you grow up, and was sports and active lifestyle always part of your life?
That's a great question. And even though I'm older now at 45, I guess sports has been an important part of my life, but it wasn't innate right from the beginning. I'm the youngest of 4 kids with my mom. and I follow closely my brother Avery because he's only a year older than I am. And as a kid, I was really quiet and shy, but Avery was this extroverted, gregarious guy. So I kind of shadowed him with whatever he was doing. And he ran cross country in middle school, so grade six. And so when he was in grade seven and I started at that school, Ryerson, back in Hamilton, I joined cross country. And I remember, I think our first day we had to run a mile around the block or something. And I stopped and walked, I don't know, half a dozen times, finished, hated it. And then our first race, I remember running and I was walking up a hill and the gym teacher who was the coach, Mrs. Lehue, you know, was encouraging me to keep running. And I remember after that, I quit. So not the best start to a running career. But then that spring, so spring of grade six, we had in gym class a week of track.
Okay.
And so we had to run a race, a lap around the track. And it's 400 meters, right? So I'm like, okay, I'll do this like everyone else. So we started, and before you knew it, I passed all the girls, and then I passed all the boys. So I won my whole class. And the gym teacher, Mr. Ted Cambridge, I remember him to this day, said, Nikki Stevenson, you're now on the track team. And it was the first time I was ever recognized in my life. And I would say, truly, my life changed that day.
Wow.
Suddenly, I'm like, wow, I'm good at something. And someone noticed. So there were two points to that. One, I'm good at something. So it opened up to running. And I enjoyed that experience running the lap around the track more than my cross-country experience. And two, I noticed that I respond well when others notice me. You know, some people are really intrinsically motivated and all they need is themselves and their determination. I see, looking back, that I am very externally motivated. So I kind of need that in my life to get the most out of myself. Mm. And from there, I just, you know, I would say success breeds success. So I just kept running and running, and it opened up a lot of doors and opportunities for me.
Cool. Mm-hmm. So where did they continue from that? So as a kid, like, it was, you know, nice to get that acknowledgement and know that you're good at something. Like, as a child, you just get super excited. You must be like 12 years old at that time. Mm-hmm. You know? So how do you follow that up? And, you know, it's all fun, I guess, at that point, you know. But
yeah, it was fun. And what was really fun was winning. That's what I loved, right? So I didn't know I was so competitive at the time, but I quickly realized I was. So I loved winning, and I really enjoyed running, even though it was, you know, it makes you feel quite uncomfortable because it's, I don't want to call it painful, but you're pushing yourself. But I think between the combination of learning to love running and immediately loving winning, then I ran through the rest of middle school, and then in grade nine started high school, where I knew I would see more competition. And I would say growing up in Hamilton, we were lucky that our high school, thanks to Mr. Wayne Hager, who was a gym teacher and also coached the cross-country team, I think we had like hundreds of kids out. And he just really encouraged everyone to join. And cross-country is great because you don't have to try out. You just join and you can be a part of it. Mm. And I think everyone goes to city championships, and after that, then it's kind of, you know, you qualify for the next level. But what was great was everyone joined. So I had a whole bunch of friends also in cross country and became a social, competitive, very fulfilling team to be on. So from there, you know, I ran well on that side. I joined the Hamilton Olympic Club, and that fed into racing on the track and that track program. And you know, growing up in Ontario with the track program, there's the club events and also the high school, like OFSA quest, I would say. Okay. OFSA is like the Olympics when you're a high schooler in Ontario.
Sweet.
So it was good that that was all set up. And luckily growing up in Hamilton, where there are a number of really good runners have come from Hamilton, is I was really well supported there with coaching and kind of that infrastructure to follow the path of a good runner.
That's awesome.
It was awesome. And it's really fortuitous. And I'm really fortunate to have grown up there because I went to school for university in the U.S. in North Carolina. And I figured everyone grew up like I did. But I learned some people went through high school with very poor coaching or no coaching, and how lucky I was to at least have got a very good foundation for, you know, understanding the basics of what makes a strong runner run fast and run well and remain as healthy as possible.
For sure. And you're right about being fortunate to have that base and that coaching, because, I mean, we weren't really coached in our high school. We just like, hey, anybody want to go to this meet?
That's right.
And I went to one, like, and I absolutely got destroyed. Because, I mean, I wasn't, no training. You know, we ran around the soccer field or whatever.
Yeah.
But how important do you think that is? So, I mean, we can translate that to, you know, competitive runners now who get the background in high school, but also for anybody starting running in their 20s or 30s, mm-hmm. like to start building a base, like how important do you find that?
I think it's important. I mean, I grew up before the World Wide Web, right? So it was more around what you can figure out on your own and your surroundings. But like one example I can give of the knowledge in Hamilton was Paula Schnur was competing in the Olympics at the time, and she's now the head coach of McMaster, right? And a well-established program. So I was around people like that. So, and that is huge, right? Compared to growing up somewhere else where you just kind of run and figure it out. So I do think it makes a difference, but I don't think it's the be all and end all. I just think I was in a lucky position. I guess the unfortunate part about it is I didn't know at the time how lucky I was. And I kind of wish, you know, if I could go back to my younger self to be much more grateful and appreciative of that. I'm trying to make up for it in my later ages. But I had no idea how lucky I was to be around such knowledgeable coaches and athletes at the time.
That's crazy. Yeah. And what's like, what does that feel like when, well, like, were they nice to you? Like, I know you could just watch them from afar, and I do that all the time. Like, mm-hmm. You never know if these people are approachable or, you know, mm-hmm. somebody of such stature, you know, like mm-hmm. it's inspirational to watch them. And but can I go talk to that person? It's always like a, were they inviting to that? Or do you remember like having interactions with them?
Yeah,
when you were younger?
I hope Paula listens to this because she influenced me early on. But just that she, I think what I really took away was Paula was like a normal person. I think she was a teacher at the time or studying to become a teacher. And just living life and a fast runner. So it's kind of she's a normal person with this exceptional talent. And but running wasn't the only thing she did. And that's what I took away from her. But also with the coaches, there's a coach, Jeff Gaynor, who's left us now, but he was a super, like his life was dedicated to running. So, and he coached people like Graham Hood, who went to the Olympics, Jason Bunston, who was an incredible runner back in the day. And he also coached my brother. So there are these kind of different levels where Jeff put even high school runners where running was the main focus of their life. And then I saw Paula as a runner, not a coach, where she was balancing running and it was a big priority for her, but not the only thing she was counting on in life. So, you know, it's interesting to see, especially when you reflect back, that you can put all your eggs in one basket with running, but you can also just make it one key component and have other things going on too.
Mm-hmm. To have that balance.
That's right. But to have that in one city, you know, and even on one track, we would train on McMaster track and you've got a handful of other coaches. My coach at the time was Kevin McKinnon, who was more of a triathlon coach. Like you have this diversity, but in the running specialty. So it was kind of neat to see everyone's different approaches to training and how important running is in their life, but not being the only thing in some cases or being the only thing in other cases.
Mm. It sounds like the Oregon of Canada.
That's right. That's right. Good old Hamilton. Yeah. I think it should be nicknamed, Oregon North, Northeast.
So did like, watching these Olympians or future Olympians, did that motivate you to kind of like, did that put ideas in your head of not, maybe not for the Olympics, but what you wanted to do as a runner?
Kind of. I mean, it's a good question, I guess, to get a bit deep about myself. I didn't see myself as that good of a runner. So I was kind of like, yeah, well, it's Paula. Of course, she's going to go to the Olympics. I'll never be that fast. I think she's running 4:01 for the 1500. You know, I think then I was trying to break 4:30. And I'm like, there's no way I can ever run that quickly. But it was very track focused. So I was trying to be a miler at the time and was thinking I'll be good, but I'm not going to be as good as Paula for sure. Mm-hmm.
So where did the high school running lead or the, where did that lead afterwards?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think in high school, I was good, but I also went to high school when Kathy Butler went to high school and she was the best. Kathy was the one who was going to go to the Olympics and break records. Like, she really was a great person for sure, but an incredible, incredible runner. So I kind of always had this underdog story about me. I also played volleyball and, you know, was trying to kind of be really good at a lot of things, but not the master of one thing. So I saw myself as good, but I didn't see, like, people put in my head Olympics. I'm like, I don't know. I don't think that's for me. I don't think I'm that good. So I kind of always had that doubt. But I also questioned the desire because I wanted to do a lot of things and not just run. But then in university, it really narrowed it down because I, you know, there I was on scholarship. You're expected to just run and put all of your focus into running and academics. So I did that. And university was a bit challenging because I went from Hamilton with growing up with a great support network and then going down to North Carolina where socially it was very different, like just the way things work there. So it was a bit of a culture shock, I would say. And then met some really great friends that I'm good friends with to this day. But running wise, I did okay, but I was injured a lot and didn't quite reach the potential I was expecting to achieve in those 4 years.
Okay.
So it would also kind of put even more doubt in my mind as to how good of a runner I could be because I don't know if you're familiar with Dina Castor, right? So she was Dina Drossin at the time and Jen Rines. So these were people I competed against or in kind of the same realm, but they were like untouchable for someone like me. I'm kind of like, I don't know. They're incredible. Here I am. I'm lucky to be racing against them, but there's no way I'm ever going to be competing really with them. They're not going to be threatened by Nicole. They've got each other to compete against. So I had that in the back of my head the whole time of I'm lucky to be here. I love being in this crowd of elite runners, but I never pictured myself as really being a contender against runners like that. And I would think looking back that if I could have put it in my head that yes, I could be there. One coach I remember told me saying, you know, they have two arms, they have two legs. You have two arms, you have two legs. There's no difference except in confidence. But I didn't have that. So I see that now, especially as a coach, one of the most important things you can do is have people believe in themselves and set realistic but stretch goals and try to erode any of those creeping doubts that come up in their minds.
Yeah, so much of it's mental, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's no matter what the distance is, you always have this internal battle with yourself. Mm-hmm. Like, can I do this? Like, you have to get over this. Like, remind yourself. Everyone's got little tricks and stuff like that.
That's right.
To kind of get themselves through it. But
yeah,
there's two questions I had while you were talking. I was thinking about it, and just like. Was it, because I hear a lot of like gratefulness, like you knew the presence, like that you were in the company of such great runners. Was it always fun for you? Like, well, even when I got more serious, did you always take on that real fun component to it, into your training, into your racing, or did it get more serious and does the mindset change? Like when you have to go to school and get a scholarship and is there pressures that go along with it too?
Oh yeah, for sure. For sure, there were pressures. Like, so in the NCAA system, the teams are rewarded by points, right? So sometimes you do races where if the points weren't there, you might not do that race, but you need to get points for your team, for your coach, for your university, whatever it may be. So it's a bit different, whereas growing up, it was all about me as an individual and how can I get the most out of myself. It was more than me in university. And then that adds pressure, right? So you're not really running for yourself. It's my coach needs me to do this for some other reason beyond my performance. And I knew I wanted to be a runner for a lifetime also. So in that, just with some of the injuries I faced, I was challenged with running through injuries. That comes at a price. But trying to win for the team and or pushing back saying no, I really need a break, and that was tough to do. It was kind of, you know, especially when you're 20, it's stuff I didn't love dealing with. But that's why I found those years. I'm grateful for them. I learned a lot. But running wise, I didn't see a lot of improvement because I think I was dealing with external pressures as well. And plus, you know, then you're in university, you're away from home. Like there's all that stuff going on. So
just being a kid.
Yeah, that's it. So I don't, you know, I have no regrets with it. It's more just the seeing I had a lot more going on than just running, even though running was really important. There were all kinds of pressures happening. And I think that affected my performance in those 4 years.
Okay. And was there something you, was there a speed, not speed, but a distance you focused on?
Yeah, that's a great question because I really wanted to. So my time in high school, I think for the 800 was 212 or something, which is okay. You're not going anywhere with that. But I knew that eventually I'd have to move up in distance, but I really wanted to break 210 in the 800.
Okay.
Because that was my big goal. And I'm like, I'm only going to do it when I'm young because the older I get, the slower I'm sure I'm going to get. So I never broke 210 because I begged my coach to put me in more 800 races, but we had a stacked 800 meter team. So I, you know, moved up to the 3000 and 5000 in university where I'm like, no, I know my future's there, but I don't want to be there yet. But this is where it's not about me. We didn't need any more points in the 800 and 1500s. It's like, well, Nick, we need you elsewhere. So, yeah, that's funny. I wish I still have my regrets, right? I wanted to break 420 in the 1500 and 210 in the 800, and maybe I can do it now that I'm approaching 50. I don't know. I don't think so.
Give it a shot. You got nothing to lose.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think when I spoke to Ariane, she mentioned kind of the same thing. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, sometimes you just got to do what the team mm-hmm. needs you to do, you know?
Yeah.
And so after university, do you continue running or because of the injuries? I know you had some mm-hmm. there's some struggles there. It's not fun being injured. Mm-hmm. How did you deal with it?
Yeah. So then I finished university and I was really homesick. So I wanted to come back home and I came back home and I realized that it's still home and it's got its own challenges. But I didn't, my big goal was to get a job. I'm like, I've got to find a job. I need to find a place to live and I want to grow up. I was quick to become a professional career or something, right? And so I kind of just ran for fun and ran on my own. And in my mid-20s, I started working at TriSport, a company that puts on triathlons. I worked there for a year and after that worked at Adidas and running promotions, which was really cool. And I was competing, but I wasn't that serious about it, but I was known as the runner. And, one thing I realized, and this was one of my goals as a coach, was that transition from university to real life. You're kind of floating around trying to figure out a whole bunch of things. And how do you keep running kind of stable and growing? Cause I saw that the years were ticking by with me kind of running half-heartedly because I wasn't focused. I wasn't sure what to do. And I wasn't asking for help from anyone. I was rolling along. So I was trying to cover that gap later on in life as a coach because I saw for myself, I kind of wasted a couple years of just, you know, figuring out growing up, really. Mm-hmm. And then one athlete that Adidas sponsored, Tanya Jones, is a marathon runner, and she encouraged me to come out to a workout with her. And she was coached by Hugh Cameron at the time. So I said, sure, I'll go out. And, you know, another lucky moment in my life, I met Hugh, and in that one workout, I remember feeling great. And I had a really good interval session. And Hugh was like, Nicole, you should be running, like running seriously, not dabbling like you're doing. So again, another lucky moment. So I started working with Hugh between him and Dave Reed at the time. And Dave put it in my head of like, you know, you're a good 10K runner, but you're a marathoner, really. I'm like, no way. I said, I'm a low mileage, like often injured runner I was never the leanest of runners either. So kind of I felt bulky for a marathoner. But so he put it in my head. And before you knew it, I ran a 236 marathon as my first real try. And I'm like, wow, okay, Dave was right. I guess I'm a marathon runner.
Wow.
Yeah, so it happened just like that. But again, another instance of needing that external support of someone to guide me to my strengths and who saw the potential there and helped me achieve something. So, so before I knew it, I was a marathon runner.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
And was there a build to it, or like from your track days mm-hmm. to a marathon?
No,
or did you do some halves and tens there?
I would say when I was coaching myself, I'd hop in 10K races and 5K races and kind of run the same times, they were decent times, not fantastic, but like a 17 minute 5K, a 34 minute 10K. Mm. So they were good enough, right? And especially not having any real goals, I was fine with that. So, and at the time I was dating, when I met Hugh, I was dating a triathlete doing Ironman. So I did a couple of those. And finally, Dave and Hugh were like, okay, enough of these, enough of the dabbling, hopping in Ironmans here and there. And let's get focused. Yeah, I know I'm strange that way. But and I guess lucky that endurance sports come very easily to me. But so it was really thanks to them getting that focus. And it was just one summer training with, there's a Dr. Mark Bailey, who was even friends with Kevin McKinnon, my coach from back in high school.
Wow.
We did a couple training runs, but Mark paced me through that marathon in Toronto. So in the summer, I did, I think it was like 100K a week, just building up to this marathon. It was really low pressure. Like, let's just see how it goes, go in, let's not overdo it. So Mark paced me, and it was like, honestly, it felt easy to go run 236. Mm. And I really thank Mark, because I just followed in his footsteps. I'm like, wow, okay. And honestly, I finished that race. I'm like, I'm going to break the Canadian record. If I did that off 100K a week, this is, this sets me up perfectly. Mm-hmm. And then what's crazy is I devoted the next 5 years to marathon running and got down to 232 and didn't run the 226 that I thought I would run. But it was still a good, that opening marathon really opened my eyes to, in my case, keep the pressure off and just let the training do its thing. And on race day, just don't overthink it. Just go with it. And, I try to instill that, but I'm a pretty intense person, so it's hard to calm my head, especially on a race day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what did, so the 100K a week, what did that consist of? And is that the magic number, do you think? 100K to be able to get up to that for a marathon, or?
I think it completely depends on the person. So I was running like 60K a week before that. I'm guessing it was so long. I'm going back 20 years. Like, it's a long time ago. But I remember running, I was probably running 7 days a week, because I didn't like taking days off back then unless I was forced with injury. Another thing I probably shouldn't have been doing. But I wasn't running too much. And the big change was adding a long run and more tempos. And then what I was thinking was, off of 100K to run that time, if I run more and push myself more, then I will get a better outcome in the marathon. So that's where I was thinking. I didn't train that much to get 236. If I up my mileage and up my intensity, I should run 226. Yeah.
I ran 245 last year, and
it's incredible.
That was like hell for me, but I can't imagine what a 236 feels like. Maybe we'll feel it one day. But we'll see.
Yeah, I think it depends on the day too. Honestly, with the marathon, probably that day was just a day where it all came together, right? So that's another kind of a mystical thing about the marathon too.
Where did you race that one?
That was in Toronto, the Toronto Waterfront.
I love that race.
Yeah, it was a bit different back then.
The layout?
Similar. Yeah. But my gosh, it was so long ago. It's so many marathons ago. Mm. But yeah, and thanks to Alan Brooks too, for it was when he was really kind of building up that series and the Waterfront Marathon itself. So it was kind of cool to be part of that way back then too, before it was built to what it is today, where it's, in the IAAF league, and it's pretty cool.
Yeah. And so did it take you 5 years to get to the 232, or was it shortly after? Like, how long did it take you to bring down that time?
So from there, and I'm probably not going to be exact on my dates. It's not my specialty, but,
just roughly.
Yeah. So I think that was in 2001, and that would have been in the fall. And then, I ran Houston and Ottawa. I don't remember if it was in 2002 or 2003, but anyway, I got it down to 234 pretty quickly. And I was pretty good at running 233, 234, like any day of the week, which was neat. Mm-hmm. But I'm like, that's not my goal. What I really want to do is break 230. So I chipped away at it. And then the fastest I got was in Houston. I think it was in 2006 of the 232.
Okay.
Yeah. But it was like, I really felt like I could go break 235 anytime, but it's not, it was great, you know, but what I really wanted was to break 230. And I even remember Mary Wittenberg, who was the head of the New York Roadrunners at the time. Between her and Dave Monty, they were recruiting me to go run New York, and they treated me like gold. They were so wonderful, inviting me to New York to go do halves and other races. And they're like, when are you going to run the marathon? And I said, I promise to do it as soon as I break 230. And then for them, I'm like, sorry, guys, I never broke 230. And, you know, your recruiting was really well appreciated. But I thought it was around the corner. So it's just c'est la vie, right? But,
yeah.
And after 2006, I took a big break from running, and it wasn't really the same anymore.
Hmm. Why do you think you didn't get there? Like, what do you, can you pinpoint it, or was it a lot of things? Or
I don't know. I mean, like people put it in my head as, you know, Ludmila Korchagina at the time was my rival, and she also trained in Toronto, and she ran 229. And she told me, she's like, Nicole, you need to run more mileage, you need to stop working, you need to watch your diet. So I had a lot of people telling me this. I had Athletics Canada saying, like, why are you working? And I kind of felt like I was trying to justify myself all the time, but it was, part of me was I have other stuff on the go, right? I was in I had gone from Adidas to pharmaceuticals, and I was doing well in my healthcare career, and I wasn't willing to give up all of that for running, because I also knew it's not a sure thing, and it would put even more pressure on me, right? So then I was just thinking, if I give all that up and put all my eggs in the running basket, knowing how I am as a super intense type A person, I didn't think it was the right thing for me. But I had a whole bunch of people telling me to do that, and I just had to constantly say no. Would it have made a difference? I don't think so, because of my just who I am. I think if there was a way for me to relax a bit more, and there was other things happening in my life that were kind of distractions, it would have helped. But I've also come to peace with, you know, I thought it'd be a walk in the park to break 230, and it wasn't. So it kind of makes me appreciate the marathon more of, you might be really good, but it is hard,
yeah.
Hard to reach your true potential,
because
you only get so many chances at it, right? So
yeah.
I think the best example was probably in 2004, and I was keyed up for Chicago. Had an incredible summer and was so fit. And the week before the race, I let things happening in my personal life affect my preparation. And by the time I got to the line, I was emotionally spent. And I ran 239 and finished 12th. Most people would be like, hey, that's good. I'm like, no, I just wasted my chance because I had some other stuff going on that I didn't put aside. So, and then 2 weeks later, I remember I went and ran the Niagara Falls Marathon and ran like, I don't know what it was, 240 or 242. And people really slammed me for that. They're like, why did you just do two marathons in 2 weeks? Like, what are you thinking? And I just remember thinking, oh, guys, you have no idea what I'm going through. And I would take back both of those races for one race at 229, like if I could. But at the time I knew I was fit, and I knew I had wasted Chicago. So I kind of was like making the best of a worst case circumstance. But I just remember a lot of pressure because I was the fastest Canadian runner at the time. And
yeah, I think was
I was
title,
trying
right?
to, yeah, Canadian. I was trying to please a lot of people. I was trying to make an Olympic team. I was trying to break a Canadian record. And I think if I just chilled out and which I'm not good at doing at all, but if I could have, that would have helped a lot. And you know, but it's whatever. I made a bunch of choices back then, but I kind of look at that now as a coach and say, okay, one of my big beliefs as a coach is you have to look at everything in that person's life. You don't need to be involved in it, but you just need to try to help focus, especially if they're trying to race at a very high level, help encourage focus on what they need to focus on. And not that you can manage what else is going on in life, but just understand it to try to take pressure off of people and get them to the level of performance that they should be at.
Yeah, it's life gets in the way sometimes.
That's right. Like
most of the athletes that I've had the pleasure of interviewing, they all have jobs and not a lot of them are just doing that, you know, working part-time, some of them, but it's a real struggle. And the more you commit to that alone, like you were saying, the more pressure that like develops, you know, it's super interesting. But I had that question in mind because I was like, how do you know where, you know, how do you know that where your end is, you know, how do you know where you can't improve anymore, you know? And I think that's something even for myself, like, I don't know. I'm going out doing my training, no pressure. Like I put pressure on myself, but to know like, okay, well, this is maybe my best and I won't be able to kind of move past that.
And I think it's a great question because it's also something that, like, I had my goal of breaking 230, but sometimes it's better to kind of leave it loose. With some people, right? Depends on personality types. But I look at Krista Duchenne. I had the honor of coaching her for a couple of years. And that was because she ran her first marathon to lose weight after children and ran 330, then ran 310. By the time she called me, I think she was at 252 and said, look, looks like I'm a pretty good runner. I'm curious as to how good I can be. So I worked with her over the next year and a half, and she won the national championship in Ottawa, and I think it was a 237 was her best, and then had another kid, and I moved to Montreal, so we agreed to part ways, and she started working with Rick Mannen, and next thing you know, she's, you know, running with Lanny Marchand, and she's a mom of three, like she has so much on the go, and I look at her, and she's just one who I think no matter what is happening in her life, she's able to put the focus where it needs to be on running, and my guess is being very present with her running. So whatever else is happening, it doesn't matter when she trained a lot on the treadmill at the time when I was working with her because of having young kids. But I really admire her in that mental discipline of being mentally where you need to be with whatever you're doing. When she's with her family, she's with her family. When she's running, she's really running. And yeah, I admired that. I remember as her coach, I said, you know, when you start the marathon, it's better to start a bit slower than goal pace and then lock in the goal pace by like 3K and you know, the real race starts with 10K to go. And she said, Nicole, with all due respect, I love starting at race pace. Like just lock it in and go. And, you know, you learn from people like that. It was so different from me with my kind of underdog. I've got to make sure I make it and kind of with all this doubt. And Krista was the first person I met with no doubt in her mind. She's like, no, this is the plan and I'm going to execute it. And I've got no doubt I'm going to execute it. And if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out, but at least this is what I know what works for me. So, you know, it's kind of neat to see how people have different approaches and really with their strengths. But with Krista, I had no idea when I was coaching her how fast she could be. I'm like, I don't know here. I just put my experience to work with the coaches I had, and she improved so much and then had another kid and then improved even more. So that's really remarkable. And you'd have to ask her, I guess, how she thinks about it. But I have a feeling she just doesn't set any limits on herself. She's like, I'm just going to put in the work and believe I'm going to get faster.
Mm-hmm. That's insane.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely believe in that more now than ever, that just putting in the work and believing in the process and everything you've put in over months of training. On race day, it's always a surprise, actually. Well, I find just from my experience, like the 245, I didn't know I could run it. And I think that's the challenge too at the same time. Like, what is that race pace? Because like, especially in marathons, and maybe you can correct me, but I'm never training at that pace. It's always like much faster or much slower. And then when you get to the race, it's like, well, this is what I would like to do.
Yeah. I know, it's just believing it'll all come together on race day. Yeah.
You know, yeah. So that's the whole challenge. How long have you been coaching for?
For about 10 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
And is Krista your the best runner you've ever coached? Or I know you've coached like numerous like top athletes. And is there any other ones you'd like to share?
Oh, I'd love to share results from all of them. Yes. Krista was the fastest, yes. But, you know, each runner I've coached has had their own story.
Yeah.
And I haven't done the stats, but I think just about every runner I've coached has hit a personal best in some event or another.
Okay.
I learn a lot from each and every person, which is what I love the most. Cause I know it makes a huge difference, the coach athlete relationship. And I know there are certain types of people who derive more benefit from working with me than others, and trying to find those people and knowing I can help them. There are others who, you know, when you're fast or you've coached fast people, then everyone starts calling you and they expect you to be their magic bullet. So I learned that when I first started coaching, I had a lot of requests, and some people who had been running for 20 years kind of doing the same thing and saying, Nicole, I know I can be faster. Can you help me? And I would write programs and call them every week, and they weren't getting faster. And these were people I was coaching from a distance. And it turns out they weren't following the program, because it's hard to change, to unlearn, right? And to agree to a new way of doing things. And that's where I found I tried to start screening people for that, just thinking, okay, if you're, even though you want to change, if you're not willing to change, there's not much I can do if you don't just kind of adapt well. And I also learned as a coach too, for my own self, to try to help those people adapt more as well and work with their strengths for what's been positive in the past, but try to correct maybe some habits that have formed. Like people who need to run a marathon every season. That's a tough habit to break, but I've got to get through to them and say, trust me, if you, depending on what you want to do, right? Okay, if that's what you want to do, great. But if you're telling me you want to get faster, we've got to break that cycle and get you changing things up for at least one season. So there's that negotiation between coach athlete, and it's just the willingness to do it is where I've found the best success. In those where it's, you know, if I'm unable to convince them, then it's just going to be kind of tense between us the whole time, because we're not on the same page. I'm trying to get them to do something that they don't really want to do. So we have to agree to either move on or find a way to work better together.
Mm-hmm. And do you find that's the biggest struggle amongst runners that you train, or is there something that common that you see in runners that you're coaching?
The most common thing is doing way too much. The runners, especially, I've coached way more people in Toronto than in Montreal. And Toronto is full of people like me, super intense, want to be really good at everything, type A's. And that's when you've really got to find the balance of, okay, you know, you're trying to progress in your career and you want all these promotions, and you're married and you want to have your kids and you want to run PBs every time you hit the line, is trying to just help put things in perspective and to set them up for success of saying, let's carve it out to goal races. So sure, you can race, but don't expect to run a personal best every single time. Let's be real, but let's aim to have a personal best every season, but not always the same event. So, you know, maybe this year it's going to be the marathon, but in September, let's focus on the 10K and trying to change that up. So just helping them really set goals and take that pressure off, but still keeping that high performance attitude, just, you know, channeling it differently and incorporating rest, which none of any runners I've coached, none of them are good at the rest, myself included, right? I either completely rest and get totally out of shape, or I overdo it. So finding the medium there.
Mm. Do you put a rest day in their plans, or is it like 7 days a week like you?
Yeah, I've learned. And I, even back in the day, so Jeff Schiebler, who was a great 5K runner back in my time, he ran 6 days a week. I'm like, Jeff, what are you talking about? You're losing a whole day. Like, do you know the percentage? You know, you could be getting more out of yourself. He's like, no, I'm convinced I need that rest day to perform better during the week. And he was an incredible runner. So now I do find ways to incorporate rest days into programs. And I'm a big believer in taking a big block of time off every year. So you take a month off where, not that you can't run, it's more just no structured running. If you feel like running, great. If you don't. I learned that from Jeff Gaynor way back in the day. He told me, look, at all the Africans take a month off in December. We all need to do that. Go do something else, have fun, Running will be back in January. So trying to incorporate more of that into Runners Today's another challenge of mine, because all of us love routine. And when you break that routine, it's hard for us to adjust to it.
Right.
Yeah.
And I found that too. Like after my last race, I was like, what do I do? Like mm-hmm. what? I told my coaches, I'm like, I need to start a plan.
Mm-hmm.
Which I took some time off. I think I took a couple of weeks off, but I was like, Boston's in April. Let's like start something slow, but something with some structure. Cause mm-hmm. like, I didn't know what to do with myself,
mm-hmm.
you know? And that was like such a hard thing to deal with. Cause you feel lost as a runner, you know? So crazy. Is there anything you pass on as far as injury prevention? Cause you did face some challenges early on. Like, is there stuff you pass along to your runners in terms of like how they can, you know, alleviate some problems or especially when you're doing high mileage?
Yeah. I think that the stronger you are as an overall athlete and maybe person, the better off you'll be. I remember when I first started coaching. So first there was Krista, who came from an ice hockey background. And then I also started coaching Kate Gustafson and Katie Snowden, who also played hockey. And these women were like unbreakable. They could handle high mileage, high intensity compared to people who've been running a long time who are always facing, you know, problems with hips or shins or something. And I always knew strength work was important. But then when you see, it's like, okay, these people come from hockey and their core is a lot stronger than people who come from just running. So, and even from my own experience, my fastest 5 years, I was meeting friends to do plyometrics 2 or 3 times a week for 45 minutes and 45 intense minutes of, you know, it was, I think, 30 seconds on, 15 seconds off. For 45 minutes, you do a lot of exercises, right, with that. And I remember also being looking very strong. Just that you're taking care of all those little weaknesses, but your whole body's strong and makes a huge difference. You just have to commit to it because runners usually just love running. But this, now I'm trying to encourage, even if it's 10 minutes every couple of days, more activation exercises, but and I need to do them myself. As you know, I currently have an injury. It doesn't take too much for injury prevention. It just takes the commitment. So it doesn't take too much time-wise, sorry, but the commitment to do the work certainly makes a difference.
Just implement a little bit here and there to kind of like strengthen the muscles. Like I find myself just doing like squats, brushing my teeth.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, just to kind of like work those stabilizer muscles and stuff like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Yeah.
Was there a big challenge in your running career that stands out that you overcame and that was like a big deal for you?
So one really good one is in 2005, I believe it was, I was known as a marathoner. And everyone knew me as the marathoner, right? Which in a marathoner, in my mind is, you're not very fast. So you can just run far. So I was invited to run the Vancouver Sun Run in April. And I remember going to the press conference the night before. At the time, Emily Mondor, who's no longer with us, but she was there and was the favorite, but she announced that she was no longer running the day before. So then it opened up everything. So suddenly there's a number of us who are good runners, but like one example is Leah Pels, right? She was a miler, an Olympic miler. So she was in there. There was a woman, an Ethiopian woman living in Edmonton. I forget her name, but she was there and she's known as really fast. And a couple others and then myself. And no one asked me a question. They're like, whatever, she's the marathoner, who cares? And so the next morning I got on the line and in my mind, I'm like, just start as hard as you can and hold on. So it's a down 10K.
Okay.
So we started and the first 3K were downhill. And I remember looking at my watch and they were like 30-something kilometers. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is going to be a disaster.
No, just no.
I think I passed the 3K in 9:15. I'm like, I've never run this fast in my life, but just believe and hang on, right? I'm a marathoner, hang on. So then, and I was with the girl from Edmonton until I think 4 or 5K, then she dropped off. And then from 5K on, I was on my own running faster than I've ever run in my life. And I was just like, okay, I've got to hang on because I know they're coming after me. So when I'm in this position, I just imagine, they're right on my heels. So I kept the pressure up on myself and just pushed every single step and wound up winning, I think, by a decent margin. I don't think anyone was behind me, even though in my head they were right on my heels, and ran a PB of, I think it was 32:29. And I remember doing a cool down with Leah, and Leah's like, I knew it. I knew it. You were, you know, everyone thought you were a marathon runner, but I knew you could run a fast 10K. And it was really, really satisfying. But again, it feeds my, you know, the theme here is that underdog status, right? So yeah. I perform the best when people aren't watching every move I make. And yeah, that was really cool. And it was fun. And then I think even I ran 32 something a couple more times. And it, you know, it was just good to know that I was a decent 10K runner too, not just a marathoner.
That's crazy. That's, I had Anne Bouchard. I don't know if you know her. She's like a... She's an ultra runner. Yeah. She had a similar story, but like in a 160K race where they were telling her, like, they're right behind you. They're right behind you. And she ends up winning by like 7 hours.
Yeah, exactly.
It's
like
great. But you find the 10Ks, like, I was going to ask you, which distance you find the most painful?
800 meters.
800 meters. Yeah, that's it's a nasty speed. But 10K is pretty bad too. When you're used to running marathons, it's like...
It's similar with 5K. Yeah. I remember another similar example was a 5K in Toronto, and you go and you run, it's down by the docks, and you run by a landfill. It's disgusting. Like, it stinks. And it's in July when it's super humid.
Oh, no.
But I remember, you know, another case where I'm one the oldest of the fast runners, and there are a couple of really fast 5K runners, and I took off like a bandit and just said, got to run faster through the landfill because it's going to stink so much, right? And it wound up running quick, yeah. But Annie Bouchard, I met at the Trans Rockies run in 2015.
Nice.
And she was incredible as a downhill runner. My gosh, she's no fear and just flew downhills while people like me were all being super cautious and taking tiny steps. I'm like, wow, she knows what she's doing.
She's incredible. And she only has been running for about 6 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I wonder, like, people that start running later in life, like, if they have almost like an advantage because they don't have the wear, you know? I don't know. Like, doing, because I played hockey and soccer growing up, but I wasn't a serious runner until 2010, but like 8-9 years ago. But I always wonder if that kind of helped me later on, you know? But
it could be. Some people think you only have so many heartbeats or so many fast running steps in your life. I like to keep it more open.
Yeah, you don't believe that?
No.
Wait, no. You were mentioning the hockey player thing, and I was like, oh, maybe that's something, you know?
I think it's just you're strong in other areas, and that makes a big difference.
What's something you accomplished that you never thought you could do?
I think, that I never thought I could do. I don't know if I'm the best person to say, because I like to think I can do anything, you know, so, or I only go for things that I think I could do, maybe is another way to look at it. But I think doing what I have done, but I'm a big believer in you go with your strengths. So kind of, I know I'm a good endurance athlete, so I lean more towards endurance. I think the biggest thing is my success as a runner, knowing a bit of my background and, not having all the confidence in the world to have accomplished what I did was great. And I think that's what I can give back to other people of don't hold yourself back and don't limit yourself like I did, which I really think I did. So to me, the more I can contribute back to other runners and just people in general, I think the better off I'll feel and knowing that I've made a difference for people. So I think it more falls along those lines with some of the accomplishments I've had as a coach. You kind of go into coaching not knowing if you're going to be good at it, right? Just because you're a good athlete doesn't mean you'll be a good coach. And I wound up helping a lot of people, and I'm really proud of that.
Cool. And can you give me like three adjectives to describe yourself as a runner?
A little bit lazy. Intense. I remember one person said I was full of rage when I run, super intense. And the third, I think, would be grateful that I'm able to do it.
Cool. Yeah, I think it's. I think you have to have a bit of rage to kind of to run a 32-minute 10K, right?
It could be. Yeah.
Before we started, you told me to ask you about Santa Rosa. I want to hear what this Santa Rosa story is.
Oh yeah. So it's what I found toughest was when I stopped running competitively. I still did a few races, but I really hated it. To be honest, I knew I wasn't going to be as fast as I used to be because I wasn't putting in the work. The desire and the drive just weren't there. But it was something I had been doing my whole life, right? So I'm kind of like, well, I should still race, but maybe just race for fun. So I tried this and it never worked because you can't take the ego out of me, right? And I think a lot of people face this. So I tried doing some other distances like the Trans Rockies run and stuff like that. And so last summer, a friend put it in my ear saying, hey, let's qualify for Boston next year together. And I'm like, okay, great. Why not? So this was in May and I looked up a race to run over the next few months. And so Santa Rosa came up, or I saw Santa Rosa. So I signed up for that and trained through the summer, you know, thought I was a rock star 8 weeks in. Next thing you know, I'm exhausted because I hadn't really done the base work. So I had a very nice long taper. And I saw my friend Steve McElligott, who's my physiotherapist, but I call him also my psychotherapist because he helps when I get myself super stressed out. And with Santa Rosa, my goal was to run 3:30, right? So Steve's like, "Mike, you're so full of crap. Like, come on." So I started out with the three. So I said 3:30. I get to the start line. I'm like, okay, I'll run with the 3:20 group. And I start with the 3:20 group. And this is what a running snob I am. Half of them have headphones on and I can hear their music and they're chit-chatting. Oh, this is my first marathon. It's great. And they're laughing. I'm like, and in my intense world, I'm like, what are you guys doing? This is a marathon. Like, you're at 3K. You're going to be exhausted in 2 hours. Like, what are you thinking? So I was so annoyed. I'm like, forget it. I have to get away from these people. I just can't run with them. I'm such a snob. But I just didn't find they were taking it seriously enough. And who am I to judge, right? I'm in my own head like, wow, you are something else, Nicole. But so I just said the best thing for me is to step away from this situation. So I went and caught up with another group. And at halfway, I'm like, I'm such a sandbagger. Like, I feel fine. So from halfway on, I'm like, I'm going to run a negative split every kilometer for the rest of the way through. So I went from like, I don't know, 5 minute kilometers to start to, and then by the time I broke off from them, I was, I don't know, around 4:30s or 40s, and then was hammering. So at the end, the last 5K, I'm passing the half marathoners who are out for a walk, right, to finish their event. And here comes through this mid-packer. Look out, I'm coming through. And I'm sprinting, running like 4 minute kilometers, coming through. And that's what told me, like, oh my, this is why I don't race. Like, I'm crazy. I am crazy. So I finished, I think I ran 3:10 and was kind of mad at myself for being such a low baller. But it was fun. It was a fun time. But yeah. It also, I find it funny because it's just, my intensity is over the top. Like, yeah. Even when I say, just go run casually, have fun, I have a really tough time doing it. Like, you get in the zone and away you go. And I just don't think you can ever take that out of someone.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, do you still have a desire to, like, it sounds like you might still have that fire to race? And
I think the fire is there, but the discipline is not. So that's the big challenge, right? So you, and even Greg Lehman, who's a friend in Toronto, I've met with him to help with my various injuries. And he's just like, you're lucky to live off a lot of residual fitness. So, you know, that again comes with gratitude. I'm lucky that I can pull off these things. If I could maybe channel my efforts a little differently, that would help. But in the meantime, they make for good stories and yeah. I get a kick out of the things I do.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun, you know, to go and do it and to live off that experience. Like, even my coaches there, when I did my second Ironman, they did their 18th. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, they trained for it, but mm-hmm. I mean, experience speaks for itself. Like, they can compete and complete these races based on just knowing what to do and, mm-hmm. and how to fuel and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. That brings me to a good point. Like, how did you, as far as nutrition went for your races and stuff, or do you have suggestions for runners or runners that you coach? something that you did during races, before races?
Yeah. I think for this, everyone needs to practice for race day. When I started running with Hugh, we would do these long tempo runs in the countryside at Newmarket. And he'd follow behind us in his van, his very old school approach. And every kilometer he'd come up and give us our splits. And I loved those runs, but I refused to drink. I refused. And so I'd finish them, feel like a rock star. And 2 hours later at home, my stomach would be a disaster. So I learned I can't be so stubborn. So I started taking water and Gatorade on those runs and worked magically. So for myself, that's all I took. I tried gels a couple of times, but I really didn't love them. And then for runners, like Krista's another good example. She's a dietitian, right? And she said, well, it's very important, Nicole. I said, well, listen, you're the expert here, not me. So she takes a gel, I believe, every 5 kilometers in her marathon. So she does a great job on the side, and it has definitely worked for her. Other people, when I shared this with others, they tried it, they couldn't tolerate it. So either you train through it and you force yourself to tolerate it, or what I prefer is more to find out what works for you, but you definitely need to take in some calories and some water along the way and practice this in your training runs. I'm not one to get overly technical or detailed in my coaching. I really find I take an individual approach with what works for each person. But it's something definitely to consider. And even in training, so that you recover better. It's not just important on race day. It's important, especially as a long distance runner, to include hydration and nutrition. I'm just not going to tell them how. I'm going to say, keep it in mind and learn what works best for you and consult with a real expert in that case.
Okay. And what did you, like, what would you go for, like, leading up to a race? Like, what kind of food, like, did you believe in the carbo loading?
I don't know if you really want to know. Because the night of my 232 race was in Houston. And I didn't have dinner plans. And I was too shy to ask anyone to go to dinner. And I didn't want to go to dinner by myself. So I hung out in the elite suite and I ate peanut M&Ms and chicken nuggets. But hey,
it worked.
Next day, maybe that was my 229 day and I blew it by not eating properly. Oh. Hard to say, but I think that it's not just one meal. It's leading up to race day, those few days, and also what you've done in training. But there's a great book that every runner should read. It's called Once a Runner. And one of the lines in it is, if the engine's hot enough, anything will burn. This is my fallback of, listen, because, you know, there was Bill Rogers who believed in McDonald's or chips or something before races. Like, don't overthink it. You know, I'm not saying go and be foolish like I have been myself, but really don't sweat the small stuff. Focus more on the big picture and putting in the consistency, the mileage, eating well most of the time, and it will all come together. I find that more people sweat the small stuff, that their focus is on things other than what I find is most important as a marathon runner. Mm-hmm.
What's your go-to cheat meal? Is it nuggets and M&Ms or?
No, I don't even like chicken nuggets. I used to be chocolate almonds and now it's really anything with sugar in it.
Okay. Really cool. So looking back on all this and you're continuing to coach and stuff like that, what does it all mean to you? What does running mean to you?
It's a deep question. Running to me means lifestyle, fun, freedom, being outside. I'm not an indoor gym kind of person. And community. A lot of my best friends are runners because we have that in common. And even when I meet people like with work stuff, you meet, and as soon as you know the other person's a runner, there's this connection that you just know what you go through on a daily basis and a bit of angst of how am I going to fit my run in today, to also that the love of the activity in the sport. So I just think running is important for so many things, but it's brought me a lot of opportunities, people, friends, and a lot of joy and accomplishments too.
Mm, awesome. Do you only coach high level athletes, or do you coach like beginners, like Would somebody starting to do a 5K be something of interest to you, or like, have you experienced that as well?
Well, I did actually. So I started coaching 10 years ago, and my goal was to be a high performance coach, especially for female runners. And my goal really was people just finishing university and looking to get into real life, but keeping runner on the burner, because that was where I fell short and where I saw a lot of others kind of, it's like many sports. You're at a very structured institution with university, and the races are all set up, training's all set up. But as soon as you have the freedom of real life, it's hard to know what to do. So I started that group, first working or volunteering at University of Toronto, and then branching off to do my own thing with the Angels, we called ourselves. And with that, we all had the intent of high performance running. But from there, I learned I was asked by people of all levels for coaching advice. And after coaching over 100 athletes, I've learned I'm really good at working with people who are dedicated. I don't care how talented you are, but I'm not the person to help motivate you to get off the couch. It's I really need people to have the desire. And if they need that, I'm just not the person for them. But if they're looking to get faster, or maybe not even faster, but looking to for a bit more structure and guidance, then I can certainly help them. And especially on the support side too. A lot of people just need the encouragement to, you know, keep plugging away at this when you've got all kinds of people asking, why do you run so much? And, you know, trying to pull you away from it. I'm the person who's going to bring you closer to it and enjoy it and really derive all the benefits there. So, and I just find, you know, having run for like 35 years of my life, I have a lot of experience to share. And going back to what I said earlier with the coaching I had, I'm so lucky and I can share that knowledge, right? So to keep that going. And I think that's a legacy of the previous coaches I've had, that it's really my duty to pass that on, and to make sure I'm helping others.
It's like pay it forward.
Kind of, yeah. And it's, I mean, on my side too, it makes me feel good, but I did step away from coaching a year and a half ago, and I took a year off just because of life busyness. And I really missed the connection with the community. So now coaching just a couple of runners and trying to be not spread myself too thin, which I'm very good at doing. So just keeping it focused to people I can really help is my objective. And I'm sure it will grow, but I've just got to manage that so I don't overcommit.
Yeah. And Ariane's one of them, right? A special runner and good friend of mine too. I'm going to hit the track with her, I think, this good. Afternoon or something.
Excellent, excellent.
And do the 800s that you hate so much. So I'm going to try and work towards that that 210 that you...
Oh, yeah, there you go. I challenge you to a 208 this afternoon.
Oh, my
yeah.
God. So where can people find out more about you if they're interested in coaching or just knowing more about you? Is there any...
Tough question, because I don't have, I used to leave it more out there. Yeah. But I think just find me on Facebook or LinkedIn or through mutual friends, is the best way to go. I did have, when I was doing my MBA, I did a project to coach, as a career, but it's not, coaching to me is not a job. It's a passion. And so I have a hard time thinking of it as a business. To me, it's more keep it casual. I might be intense, but I'm a pretty low key person. I'm not big on the promotional side of things, except in my job, I'm in marketing, but for myself, it's not my deal. So, I think just through word of mouth.
Okay, cool. And, any upcoming goals that you plan on taking on?
Have fun, do my strength work, fix my Achilles. Yeah. My goal really is to run for the rest of my life. One person I look up to is Ed Whitlock, who, my gosh, when I was in my 20s and he was probably 60 something, we competed in a mile together. And here I was thinking I'm 25. Who's this old guy with the white hair beside me? And Ed challenged me all the way to the line. And then we were both running marathons at the same time. And I just saw that he took a break from running when he was middle age, right? Just because of life, and then took it up again as he got older. And, you know, he broke records in his 70s and ran all the way till the end, till he was 85. So I think if I can accomplish something like that, of not necessarily having the records, but just enjoying running and being healthy enough to run to the end, that'd be fantastic.
Amazing. Similar to that, I met a guy at my first Ironman, and he was like, he qualified for Kona in Hawaii. He was 7 years old. He was only, I think there was two competitors. And his name is Tommy. And I was like, Tommy, like, great to meet you. Like, my coaches know him and stuff like that. They said, say hi. And I said, like, after all these years, like, you know, congratulations, like, you're going again. And he said, he's like, at my age, you don't have to beat the competition. You just have to outlive them. So it's a testament, you know, it's something I share the same sentiment. It's something I'd love to do for a very long time.
But it's easy to step away from it. I call myself a person of inertia. When I'm in the routine, I'm there, right? But as soon as I'm injured, I fall off. And what a body in motion stays in motion, a body at rest stays at rest. So it's kind of making sure if you do run into challenges with life or injuries, and sure, you take a few months, but then reach out to your people to get you back on it, because it's worth it.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you. It was fun.
Yeah, I really appreciate having you in and sharing this conversation. It's not something that we've been able to fully get into in the past, but I'm grateful that we had this this opportunity to do so.
Thanks, Justin. It was fun.
Thanks.
This episode is brought to you by the Outrun Retreat, the perfect combination of running, yoga, and wellness, all rolled into one weekend in the great outdoors. Join them May 30th to June 2nd at a beautiful cottage tucked away in the Eastern Townships. Elite runner Ariane Rabi and her team will guide you every step of the way, helping you set new goals and objectives for 2019. For more information, visit theoutrun.ca. See you out there. Thank you for joining us on this episode of The Rundown. We hope you enjoyed our show. Please make sure to visit us at imarunner.ca. You can also let us know what you think and follow us on Instagram at The Rundown. Now take what you've learned and run with it. The Rundown is a production by WRG Media, recorded in the historic RCA building in downtown Montreal. Produced and recorded by Forrest McKay. Our executive producers, Leslie and Lindsay Woods. Graphics and illustrations created by Ryan Bondi with assistance by Mark Grimberg. Marketing by Joe Garcia and hosted by me, Justin Pugliese.